Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit MOFAD.org.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef Story, and today we are broadcasting from the International Culinary Center, but for the very first time, we are live streaming this, so let's give it to the crowd here and to everyone watching us on live stream. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yes, go for it, go for it. All right, are you ready to rumble with Eric Repair? I can't believe that for the inaugural of doing this live streaming, we were able to get Eric here. It's an unbelievable honor at the school for Eric to be here. For those three people in the world that don't know who Eric is, he is probably one of the most celebrated chefs in the world. Aside from the extraordinary accolades of 3-star Michelin, number 24 on the 50 greatest restaurants in the world, he's won almost every Beard Award, including the Outstanding Restaurant in the United States. He's written 6 books, the last one a memoir, which we'll get into. He is one of... You know, you say about some people, they are gentle giants. I think Eric defines gentle giant. You're a giant in our industry, and I want to crack it open and find out how everyone can be as gentle and as beautiful a person as you are. Eric, thank you for coming today.
Well, thank you. I'm going to come back again and again.
So, on the show... first of all, I want to say Vive la France. It's Bastille Day,
yes.
And it is a great honor of mine. The French chefs have been so generous to this country. I don't think we would have our Thomas Kellers, you know, and other young American chefs, the Jonathan Waxmans, if they didn't go to France, and you guys show us how to do it. But we're going to talk about you. This is all about you.
Okay. And thank you.
I start these chef stories with delving into someone's childhood, and usually I don't know much about it. But you are the bravest soul to have written 32 Yolks. Can I ask how many people here have read this? Okay. A lot of you are in for a treat. You're going to run. Well, we have some that we're going to sell in the back. But this book is so brutally honest and so startling, I don't even know where to begin. Let me just say to everyone that this wonderful man was born in the south of France, and he has the disposition of a Provençal, you know. But his childhood was very challenged for a lot of reasons. And... The first thing I want to ask you is, how could you write the memoir? I mean, it was so raw, and it's so surprising to a lot of people. How could you be so honest?
Well, I thought when you write a memoir, you're supposed to be honest. I was very naive, I guess. But the truth is that Random House pursued me for 2 years to write the memoir, and I was not very excited about writing my memoir because I thought I had no story to say. I didn't think I have anything inspirational. But after 2 years, I finally wrote on a piece of paper the chronology of my life as a young child and a teenager and so on. And I realized that actually I have interesting things to say and I have an inspirational legacy. And 32 Yolks is exactly what it is.
So when you were an only child.
Yes.
And you were very close to your mother.
Very close to my mom.
Yeah. And
not a mama's boy.
No, you get this in the book. But you were very, very sad and angry from a very early age.
Yes.
And where did that come from, do you think?
Well, I was born very lucky in the south of France, in Antibes. My parents were very successful. They were living in Saint-Tropez in the 1970s. Saint-Tropez and the 70s, Brigitte Bardot era, was challenging for couples. And overnight, my life changed because my parents didn't make it. They divorced. My mother remarried. And my father as well, and then he passed away when I was 10. Therefore, my life became very difficult as a young child because I didn't accept very well the fact that my mother would remarry someone that I really dislike and who was disliking me as much as I did. And it was war at home, and I had no place to really to go. The only peaceful moment, inspirational moment of the day or of my life was at the table. So we had, of course, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and that was, for me, a moment of great pleasure and peace. My mother, who was a very successful woman, would make sure that she would wake up at 5 or 6 a.m., prepare breakfast, and then she would prepare lunch and dinner. And she will prepare appetizer, main course, dessert. And that will be served at home on different china patterns with different tablecloths and so on. So that was a really real experience. And that meal will bring peace and the family together. And I thought that actually every child in the world was eating the way I was eating. Like that, so refined. I had 2 grandmothers also who knew I had a passion for food, mostly eating, because when you are 5-6 years old, you're not necessarily a chef. you don't know you're going to become a chef. And they knew I love food, so they would cook for me soul food. One grandmother was Italian, so part of my education was soul food from Italy, and the other one was from Provence. And my mother was inspired by the chefs of the 70s, Nouvelle Cuisine, and it was Paul Bocuse and Michel Gérard and all those chefs. So I had soul food and very refined food at the same time. And it created my passion for eating first, then for what we call in French, l'art de la table. And then I find my way going to the kitchens, of course.
So one of the things that struck me in the book, in a very raw way, was how angry you were at 5 or 6 when your parents got divorced, and how you rebelled, and how you were really tough on, you know, on yourself and with the world around you. And digging back there, digging down deep, did that make you a stronger person?
Well, first of all, to be tough, it was a matter of survival because I was at war with a very abusive stepfather, abusive verbally and physically, in the sense that he was beating me and so on. And I was very young. I was 6, 7, 8 years old. I was at war with him. And actually, he should have never done that, because you all know that if you go at war with a young kid, you're going to lose the battle. And I won, but still. I was very angry, it's true. Very angry, very sad at the same time. Mm. But when I started to cook as a student, finally, suddenly, I started to have passion, and I overcame that anger. Although until my arrival to America, I was a guy with a bad temper, very bad temper. And actually, it's not in the book, but when I started in the U.S., I was this young chef who had those tantrums and was breaking plates on the floor and screaming at the cooks. And I realized that, I realized first that they were leaving me. The team was not staying on board, and I was miserable as well. And I sat down, and I reflected on my life, and I said, you know, I have to change my way of living. And at that time, the Dalai Lama was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace. His speech of acceptance became a great inspiration, and I was attracted to Buddhism. And then that became my spirituality, my guidance. And today it's what makes me someone who's very peaceful, very happy. You know, it changed me.
We need to explore this more, because I can't go deeper into the childhood. You can read this in the book, but it's mesmerizing. And to know you, and when I said gentle giant before, I wasn't kidding. He's such a gentle man. But the abuse continued after you went to cooking school. A little bit, you know, they steal you in cooking school, and especially in France. We don't nearly do it here the way they do it in France. But when you went to Robuchon, you know, you went to Tour d'Argent, and then you went to Robuchon. That struck me as an abusive, mentally abusive place as well. And did you know, and physically abusive, you had no life, right? So how does one stand that?
Well,
explain your day at Robuchon.
I think Joël Robuchon was an exception to the rule, because a lot of the kitchens in France at that time were very violent in terms of like physical abuse, again, like being beat up, being screamed at. Joël Robuchon was against violence, and he was not a screamer himself. What was very difficult was the hours that we put into the kitchen. We were 25 cooks for serving 40 covers every lunch and every dinner. And because his demands were very precise, and the food that we were cooking was so amazing at the time, we would work about 16 to 18 hours a day. But Joël Robuchon kitchen was an exception to the rule. Other kitchens, you will see pans flying, plates being broken, chefs screaming, kids being kicked in the butt, and so on. So when I went to Joël Robuchon, I was very inspired in a way. At the same time, Joël Robuchon was very demanding on himself, very demanding on his team as well, of course. And we were all on board with him. We all wanted to create something unique and amazing with his guidance. He had this tremendous vision, and he was considered at the time in the 1980s, and even today he's considered the best chef in the world, or one of the best chefs in the world. We knew it was a price to pay. He was working the hours with us. He was not staying home watching TV and calling us. But he was this kind of very rigorous, very serious, demanding professor. And when he was not satisfied, you will look at his face and you will be terrified. And you wouldn't have to talk. You know, you have those teachers sometimes, like they terrorize the class and they haven't said anything yet. I don't know if you know them. But Joël Robuchon was like that. When he would get frustrated, he would not get the quality that he wants. you could feel the pain in him, and it will be contagious. And then he will start to ask you, why you did that? Why did you sabotage the dish with the lobster? Why, you have no respect for the lobster? And then he will say, but you don't care about the craftsmanship? You don't care about the artistry of cooking? And then he will say, you don't care about the clients? And that will really hurt you, because we all care. But that was the way of Joël Robuchon in terms of teaching. And it was, for sure, terrorizing at times, because you didn't want to be the one who sabotaged the dish and disappointed the master. But again, I like to make a point here that he was absolutely against violence. And that was a plus.
Yes, there was not... I was terrified reading that portion of the book, and we're going to take a little break.
Hi, this is Peter Kim, the executive director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. We're a nonprofit founded by Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues here on the Heritage Radio Network, and we want to take people on a learning adventure through the world of food. We just opened MOFAD Lab, our gallery space at 62 Bayard Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where we are currently showing Flavor, Making It and Faking It. Flavor features some very cool sensory interaction. Flavor tablets deliver tastings of vanilla and umami, and the Willy Wonka-inspired smell synth lets you compose over 500,000 different flavors. So come on by and visit MOFAD Lab. We're open 5 days a week, and tickets are $5 for kids and $10 for adults. Learn more about the Museum of Food and Drink at MOFAD.org.
Okay, now we're back. Welcome back. You're watching Chef's Story and listening to Chef's Story. And today we're broadcasting from the ICC, International Culinary Center, and have an extraordinary guest, Chef Eric Repair of Le Bernardin. I think I even forgot to say your restaurant when I introduced you, because I just think the whole world knows. So let me get into this formation of chefs. We are a cooking school. And it strikes me, you were just saying, 18 hours. I just remember you said you get home and you could hardly even sleep because you had to get up to get back there. 18 hours a day, six days a week?
No, five days a week.
So that had to put in you a certain level of not only discipline, but steeliness and mastery. And is there any place in the world that still does that? And do you think that we are not going to have chefs of your caliber, since that's not, you know, if people don't go through that?
Well, we were doing 18 hours a day, it's true, and we were extremely focused and dedicated. I believe that you can have the same focus, the same dedication, the same passion without doing 18 hours. And the laws have changed since. And I don't know if in Europe some kitchens have their employees for 18 hours in a restaurant. I doubt that. At the time, it was common practice. It was not necessarily specific to Joël Robuchon. It was in almost every restaurant where you were going very early, you were serving lunch. Sometimes you were having a little break to go have an espresso or two, or three, or four. And then you will come back wired with the espresso. and you will go through the night. And by the time you go home after cleaning the kitchen, because at that time in Europe, and I don't know today, but after cooking, you were cleaning the stove and you were cleaning everything and the hood system and everything. So we were very young. We were strong physically. And the fact that we had 2 days off was, I think, a good thing, because on 6 days you wouldn't be able to do that.
Can I ask how much you were paid back then?
I don't remember exactly the salary. It was in francs, but I remember that actually in the kitchen of Robuchon we were very happy because we were paid above average compared to other restaurants. So he was very respectful of his employees. And he wanted to make sure we were not making a fortune, for sure. And we were young kids, and we were there to learn. We were there because we knew he was going to be a great teacher, and it was a very special place. But at the same time, he was making sure that we could pay our rent. We were eating at a restaurant, but he wanted to make sure that we had a decent salary.
A decent life. So can you also talk about how long you stayed at one station before you moved on, especially coming out of culinary school? What was the road? Because you learned some basic things in culinary school, but your real life work.
I'm going to talk about La Tour d'Argent now.
Yeah.
So La Tour d'Argent was very different than the kitchen of Joël Robuchon. With the volume, we were doing much more covers, and we were as many, we had maybe 25 cooks for 100 and something covers. And in La Tour d'Argent, I'm sorry, Dorothy, can you ask me again?
When you came out of, you know, how long would you be put at a station to work? Because people want to, you know, go up the ladder so fast here. What did it take when you came out of culinary school?
So after, when I went to La Tour d'Argent, I was in a station, in a fish station for 6 months. And then they started to move me, and they put me in a meat station and then the vegetable station. I stayed only one day in a pastry station because I ate 25 strawberry tartelettes, and I was sent back to the kitchen. And therefore, I'm a very bad pastry chef. But La Tour d'Argent had this tradition of making sure that as soon as you were comfortable, you were moved to another station. In Joël Robuchon kitchen, it was a little bit different. He would keep you a very long time because in his mind, for you to master the station and the sauce and every aspect of the recipes, it was a long process. Therefore, my first stint at Robuchon was 1 year in a garde-manger.
One year in garde-manger?
Yes.
That's sort of salad prep for people out there that don't know, you know, and appetizer. I mean, was that frustrating for you?
No, because it was so much to learn. We were changing the menu all the time. He was changing techniques all the time. He was throwing new challenges at us all the time. The seasons were passing by. And actually, it makes sense because if you think about it, you change the menu with the season 4 times. It's always something new for 3 months. Then I did my mandatory military duties at the time. When I came back, I went back to Joël Robuchon, and I stayed in a fish station for 2 years.
2 years?
2 years. And then I asked him to send me somewhere, and he sent me to America.
Well, let me go back to 2 years in Garde-Manger and a year in the fish station. What is technique? I mean, I take this from in teaching in a school. Somebody learns how to hold a knife or do a julienne or something like that, and they think they mastered a technique. What is mastering a technique?
Mm. Well, it goes in stages. And it's true that knife skills, it's a technique, but it's the most basic technique that you will ask a cook to master the knives. It's like boiling water. I mean, the ultimate in cooking is when you achieve the level of being the sommelier, and in between mastering your knife skills and becoming a sommelier, it takes years. Years because you learn how to, of course, how to cut, how to cook, all the techniques, baking, sautéing, poaching, roasting, and so on. You learn the meat, you learn the fish, you learn how to cook vegetables, you learn presentations, you learn how to plate properly and hot food, delicious food on a clean plate in a timely manner. But when you arrive at the sauce, that's really the end of the training before you become a sous chef, which is management. The saucier is the most difficult thing to learn because flavors, and you all know that, do not exist in terms of, they're not tangible. You cannot touch 2 inches of rosemary flavor. You cannot touch 3 inches of mint, sage, garlic. It doesn't exist. It's all in the mind. It's like music. The saucier has to catch the flavors into a liquid, which can be as thin as water or rich, I mean, depending what it is. But he has to catch the flavors, and he has to make sure that those flavors are going to be stable, vibrant, during the service, which could be from 12 to 2 or at night during the night shift. That's really, really something difficult because it requires a lot of craftsmanship, but then it requires a certain instinct that you have developed over the years. And some people have it, and some cooks don't are not really good at it, and it's almost impossible to teach that. It's like, if I can make an analogy here, it's like teaching piano to someone, and someone's going to play piano, but he will never be able to maybe compose great music or play piano with soul. So the saucier is the crown on the head of the chef or the cook.
What is the most technically difficult dish you have ever made?
Many. You know, sometimes very simple dishes are the most difficult. You know, let's say you have a piece of fluke, you have a lime, you have an onion, a bit of cilantro, and you have a knife and a cutting board. You don't have too much room for error, and of course you're going to make a ceviche, but if you're very good, you're going to make a delicious ceviche. If not, you're going to make something that is a piece of fish cut
with some herbs. So explain to me, what is the technique of a ceviche that's so... What's a masterful technique in ceviche?
Well, the quality of the ingredient is key. Mm-hmm. So the fish obviously has to be fresh because, as you know, if you start cooking with mediocre ingredients, you can imagine at the end of the process how mediocre your food is going to be. So something very, very fresh, very good instruments because the cut is very important. I think actually the Japanese master the cut and can teach the entire planet how important the cut is with the knife, because depending how dull your knife or how sharp it is and the angle of the knife, you will get a different texture from the fish. Then you have to you use your instincts. I mean, of course, you may do a julienne of cilantro. You may squeeze the lime. You have salt. You have probably other ingredients in your pantry. But suddenly, it's when your talent will shine or will not shine. It's putting the exact seasoning, the exact amount of aromatics in the dish that will elevate the fluke and will not kill the flavor of the fluke or basically make it dry and tasteless. All of that I think to achieve that, you have to practice for a lot of years, and you have to have this kind of like gift in you.
How long do you think it took you to be ready to be a chef?
I'm still progressing every day. But I will say, until you master the sauce, you're not prepared to become a sous chef, and it takes years to master sauce. And even today, I mean, the sauce that I really know and that I have sometimes created challenge me, but I always find a way to. By instinct, again, to get what I want. But it takes 5, 6, 7 years. Then being a sous chef, I think, is very important. You learn how to manage a team. And I cannot say you're going to be the sous chef and you guys are going to listen. Because if you don't know what you're saying, if you give the wrong orders, after many mistakes, the team will not follow you. You will get respect only when you have mastered everything, and when you give an information or you ask someone to give you something, you have to be right. The team has a very low tolerance for mistakes. When you have mastered being a sous chef, which take a couple of years, three, four years, then you become a chef. So you're on your own, and it takes time for you to find your style and you find your pace and you find your a certain comfort in that position. So I will say, if you really are looking to become a good chef, in average, is a minimum 10 years. And it's still a work in progress. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, you're never done.
So you cook what we call haute cuisine, you know, and Robuchon and the great restaurants, the three-star Michelin restaurants. And how much technique do you need for haute cuisine versus just a simple restaurant? Or do you need a difference in, you know, what is the difference? Is there a higher calling being haute cuisine? Is it?
It's a different exercise. And I have a lot of friends of mine who are cooking in bistros and casual restaurants and who have great ingredients, cook amazing food, delicious food. It's a little bit different than what we do in fine dining. In fine dining, very often, I mean, what makes a difference is, first of all, it's not just about craftsmanship and duplicating a dish that could be on many menus. It involves creativity. Creativity, it's what brings artistry in cooking. If not, it's just craftsmanship. And fine dining, you have to be very consistent. Constantly innovating and being consistent is a huge challenge. And I think this is the main difference, because you can eat something very good in a casual restaurant, but in fine dining you will eat something hopefully as good, but in a consistent way, and always having someone pushing the envelope to be at the head of the curve. You basically, in terra incognita, you create, and sometimes you make mistakes and you come back, but you are at the head of the curve. But fine dining is also about creating an experience that is very unique, and that requires not only the kitchen to be excellent. It's about being in a surrounding that will help to create this experience that will be memorable for years. The dining room staff has a big role in that as well, reading the mind of the client, knowing if you're coming because you are a foodie, or it's your birthday, or you're in business, or you're in love, or you're going to get engaged. It's a holistic experience, if I may. And ultimately, people come to fine dining restaurant most of the time to have this kind of one-of-a-kind experience. And you go to other restaurants to eat and have a good time, but it's a little bit different.
Well, we're going to have to take another break. And when we come back, I've got another question. Today, my guest is Eric Repair of Le Bernardin of 5 cookbooks. You too can go home and try to make the fluke ceviche. But I'm going to ask you, I'm going to look at some of my questions because there's some really good ones here, and I don't want to. But what were you thinking when you came to the United States? I mean, coming out of Joël Robuchon's kitchen and landing at Jean-Louis Paladin, right, in Washington.
Yes.
What year was it? What were your first thoughts? What had you expected from America? And what were your first reactions?
It was in 1989. Well, first of all, I asked Joël Robuchon to send me somewhere. So he said, where do you want to go? And I said, Brazil. And then he laughed. He's like, I'm not sending you on vacation. Then I said, Spain. He said, but you grew up close to Spain. So then I said, well, anywhere you want me to go. And he said, I have an idea. You should go to Jean-Louis Paladin in Washington, D.C. So I came in America in 1989 without speaking a word of English, naively thinking that it will be okay. It wasn't okay. It was really hard. Jean-Louis Paladin was a French chef, and I thought he would speak to me in French. He spoke to me in English, and in bad English. So that the language was extremely challenging. Coming from a very structured kitchen with 25 cooks, like we had in Joël Robuchon, and coming to America and having a nice kitchen, but 6 or 7 cooks, and I had to be more versatile in the kitchen, was a challenge. The pace of the kitchen was a challenge. The ingredients were challenging. They were not the same. Not like they were bad, because Jean-Louis Paladin had always great ingredients, as we all know. He was a pioneer with Alice Waters, going to the farmers and bringing vegetables from them, or going to talk to the fishermen and people who forage mushroom and so on. So the quality of the ingredients was good, but they were slightly different. The pace of the service was very different. I didn't understand the tickets. He was screaming at me, and I think he was saying, God damn it, but I'm not sure. So I was, culturally, I was a bit lost. So it was not that easy. I thought coming out of the kitchen of Robuchon in Paris and coming to America would be not a piece of cake, but I was like, I'm gonna show off a little bit in those kitchens. And not at all. I mean, you have some very good cooks in America, as we all know, but in the kitchen of Jean-Louis, he had those ladies, he had 3 ladies coming from South America who were doing the same thing year after year. They were experts, and they were much better than I was at certain things that they were doing. So that was very humbling, my arrival in the U.S.
How long were you in that kitchen?
I was with Jean-Louis for 2 years.
And at the end of 2 years, what was your first impression of America? Let's get off the food thing. You came here, you probably, you know, you were in the land of Brigitte Bardot, and then you go to Washington, the politics of Washington and Watergate.
Yes. I mean, Washington for a 24-year-old is a bit boring.
Probably for a 56-year-old, too.
But my dream was to come to New York. And Jean-Louis knew that. So I was coming to New York on the weekends or when I had days off. And actually, I was coming in this neighborhood. And after 2 years, my visa had to be renewed and something. I mean, I don't remember technically what it was. But it was an opportunity for me to move on. And Jean-Louis helped me. I went to David Boulay briefly. I left, by the way, Jean-Louis, I was a line cook. I left him as a sous chef, thank God. And then I came to New York. I worked with David Boulay for a few months. And then I started in 91 with Gilbert Lecoz at Le Bernardin.
Can you tell people about Gilbert?
Yes. So Gilbert Lecoz came in America in
85.
He came previously to that, and he didn't find the ingredients that he liked, and therefore decided not to open a restaurant. And at that time, I think basil was something very exotic. You find it only dry; it was not fresh. He was in shock when he saw the quality of the fish at the fish market. The fish was not handled properly. He was a purist. And then he waited until 1985, when finally he started to see some improvements and find ingredients that were available on the market that were inspiring to him. And in 1986, he opened Le Bernardin, and Le Bernardin was a revolution. I mean, New York Times gave Le Bernardin 4-star immediately, and it was, I think, the first time that A seafood restaurant was fine dining. Until then, it didn't exist.
What did Le Bernardin bring to America at that time?
Well, the experience of fine dining from France, and in terms of cooking, it was an homage to the beautiful products that we have in America. Seafood, because Le Bernardin is a seafood restaurant. And I think the press and the clients were in shock by how amazing and simple and delicious the food was at Le Bernardin.
So what position did you start in?
So in 91, Le Bernardin was already a success since 1986. I was the chef de cuisine of Gilbert. And he was letting me do a lot of mistakes, always encouraged me. And I worked 3 years with him. And in 1994, he passed away and I took his position.
What did you learn from him?
From him, I learned a lot of things. I learned how to manage a team, how to be inspirational, creativity, discipline. All the qualities that chefs must have. Humility as well, because he was extremely humble as well. Jean-Louis Paladin, well, I'm going to tell you, La Tour d'Argent, I learned the classics and the basics. Joël Robuchon, I learned technique, rigor, precision. Then when I went with Jean-Louis Paladin was an artist, a little bit hippie like that. And the difference was, another analogy, it's like leaving a Catholic school and going to a Woodstock concert, something like that. So Jean-Louis opened my mind in terms of creativity. And then Gilbert Lecoz allowed me to be creative, use all the techniques that I had learned with Joël Robuchon, and he taught me how to be a chef, how to be a leader in a restaurant, how to have a team that follow your orders, and how to be, of course, relevant, when you don't lose money. You have to...
Yes, you have to be a responsible business person.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So you were a young cook, and young cooks go from kitchen to kitchen and sous chefs, and you help them in their career by going. What is it that you would like people who worked in your kitchen to say about you in your kitchen? Not necessarily you, Eric, as a person, but in your kitchen, what kind of kitchen is it? Because every kitchen is different.
Well, I want the cook to learn as much as they can at Le Bernardin, of course. And I want them to be inspired, to be taking risks in their career, and to lead teams by being kind, because I learned over the years with my mistakes that a cook, a waiter who's shaking like that is not going to do a better job than someone who's happy to be in a kitchen and is inspired to cook. So I would like for the cooks who leave Le Bernardin to tell me that.
Do you have a passion for fish, or could you easily, happily have a restaurant with a more varied offering?
I have passion for fish. It's no doubt. I would have left. I definitely have a passion for fish. And I have to say also, during my entire career, I always ended up in a fish station and spent a lot of time in a fish station. Even with Jean-Louis Paladin, I spent half of my time cooking meat and being a sous chef, and half of my time cooking fish. And it's really something that I enjoy and love. And it's very different than cooking meat. Cooking meat is something very sensual. And like Jean-Louis Paladin used to say, you cook with your guts. And cooking fish, you have to be a technician. You have to be very attentive. If you cook a stew and you leave the stew 5 minutes extra, it's okay. A steak is going to be forgiven. A roasted chicken, if same thing. A piece of fish, if you leave the fish in a pan for 10 seconds extra, the fish is ruined sometimes. It will be overcooked, it will be dry, it will be tasteless, and so on. And I like that challenge. I like the challenge of being extremely focused, extremely cautious, of course, because as we all know, a fillet of fish is very fragile. When you handle it, it's not like handling a chicken again. Not like it's anything wrong with cooking chickens. But I love the challenge of cooking seafood. And I love that you're always on a thin line. But a good cook should master both cooking meat or vegetables and meat, of course, and cooking fish, because it's different, but you cannot be a good chef if you don't master both aspects.
Chefs are generational. I've noticed that in my 33 years here. That, you know, when I started the school in 1984, you had Paul Bocuse and Roger Verger, right?
Yes.
And then the Young Turks with Daniel Boulou, right? And today, you know, we have probably two more generations of chefs. Somebody said to me, I said, oh, you mean a young chef like David Chang? They go, no, he's not young. He's middle-aged. No, the young chefs are Jeremiah Stone and, you know, Fabi. And I found that amusing that, you know, David's no longer a young chef, you know. And
so I'm ready to retire.
Who are there young chefs that inspire you? I'm not going to ask a general question. What inspires you? I would love to know what restaurants or who are people cooking today. I mean, you get more and more. I don't mean rarefied in a big-headed sense, but the more and more you learn and perfect your technique, it must be harder to be excited and inspired by other people's cooking. Maybe I have it wrong, but where have you been lastly inspired, and who today is cooking that inspires you, all through the generations, young cooks, old cooks?
Well, it's two kind of cooking, is good cooking and bad cooking. And, of course, you have some young cooks who are very talented, and you have some old cooks who are very talented, and if David Chang is old...
I won't tell you who said it. It was a pretty famous person themselves, but young.
I see a lot of young chefs with a lot of talents, and they inspire me tremendously. The last very, very big experience that I had that really like blew me away was actually in California at Saison.
Oh, Josh Skeens.
Yes.
He's a graduate of French Culinary. Shout out to Josh.
So Josh is. I mean, that was my last amazing, amazing meal.
What made it amazing?
He has created a style that is very unique to himself, and I love the way he's playing with fire, the different intensity of the fire. Using different woods, using instruments to send some smoke from almond trees, a little bit like that to the ingredient, and then another ingredient will be with much more smoke. Another one will be closer to the fire. Another one will cook very far away from the fire, and it does fermentation, experimentations. Whatever it touches is unbelievable, and that was my last, and it was not too long ago. And I was so impressed, I asked him to come to Le Bernardin and do a lunch for the press.
Really?
Yes.
Has
and
that
we
happened
gave him,
already?
We gave him our kitchen upstairs, and he brought his wood and everything. And yes, I mean, it was very impressive to look at that. Now, another chef who will be more like my generation is Australian. And no, it's... is a sepia in Sydney. His name is Ben, and he's an incredible chef as well. And he actually has a seafood restaurant.
And what kind of influence on that food?
He has his own style again. Whatever he does, it's inspired by his experiences, and he's using a lot of modern techniques, the heritage of molecular cuisine, but he integrated it in a more classical way, and it brings a lot of power and lightness to his food, exactly like José Andrés, who does that very well.
Before I open it up, and we are going to open up to questions.
This kitchen is a real kitchen.
Yeah, it's hot.
I should have bring my jacket.
It's hot in the kitchen, yes. Sorry, the water cooler today was worked overtime. I do, you know, I don't usually go to women's issues, but can you see any discernible difference between a woman's touch as a chef, you know, in professional kitchens and men? You know, a male chef versus a female chef. Do you think there's any discernible difference?
No, I don't see that. I mean, obviously, a lot of, if you have something to lift and it's very heavy, very often, and this is it's nature, some guys are very strong and they can lift the pot very easily, and sometimes it's more challenging for some ladies because they're not built like the guys.
I don't mean working in the kitchen difference. I mean if you go to Dominic Crenn's restaurant or, you know, Anita Lowe, can you see a femininity in the cook? Have you noticed as an eater of great chefs, can you see a difference in the food? Or feel, you know, did you ever notice that?
No, I will say no. Because what is feminine in terms of flavors and what is masculine in terms of flavors? You have some women chefs who cook with a lot of power, some women chefs who are very delicate in their combinations, but you have the same with some male chefs. Who are very delicate in their precision and in creating harmony in the plate, and some chefs who have a lot of power and bring a lot of strength to the flavor that they develop. So I don't think we can generalize and say women cook a certain way and men will cook another way.
So before I open it up, my last question to you is, do you have a wish for our profession of something happening either in the kitchen or in the restaurant industry that you feel can really contribute, be our generation's contribution to the food legacy?
Well, yes, I do, of course. Whoever is going to have a restaurant, whoever is going to be hopefully successful in the future, hopefully we'll have some concerns about sustainability. Today is a cross world, right? I mean, our planet, as we know, it's potentially endangered. Some species are disappearing everywhere. We see a lot of pollution. We see a lot of mishandling of pesticides and things like that. And I hope that the next generation of chefs and whoever is involved with food will have a conscience and reverse what has been a disaster for the last 30, 40 years.
Do you think chefs have to be political? I mean, they can't just live in a bubble?
It's not about being a chef. It's about being a citizen of this, about being a guest of this planet, and about leaving this planet in a better shape for the next generation, or not leaving it in a better shape. Chefs, of course, have a voice today, thanks to the media, thanks to the attention that we're getting, and because we touch so many lives. Therefore, we have a lot of power when we deliver a message. But whoever is involved with food, I hope, will, in the future, consider that a big priority. Because it's easy to make a carrot taste good, in a sense. I mean, it's not easy, but it is. But if the carrot had pesticides and polluted the water and the soil, and the carrot was GMO, and it has an impact potentially on bugs in the future or on our health, if the chicken has growing hormones and antibiotics and is GMO as well, and we're caring only about those kind of things, well, we're going to the abyss. If you like to eat a species of fish that is disappearing and you don't care, well, that species will disappear and then it will be the next and the next and the next. So therefore, I think it's very, very important today to think about sustainability.
Bravo. Okay. We got a question. Okay, we're going to take questions from the audience. Trevor.
Chef, hello. Thank you for coming. So you spoke about sustainability, and you've also spoke about your love of seafood and all of that, and I feel like seafood is a big issue right now for as far as freshness from the ocean and availability and things like that, and farm fresh fish has become a lot more prevalent and is almost, most chefs I feel like are leaning towards farm fresh instead of the ocean because there's not as much. Maybe you're shaking your head.
I'm sorry. I don't finish your question.
So do you feel like we should definitely stick to the ocean still, or do you think that we should try to look for sustainable farming practices to try to rebuild the population in the ocean of certain seafood wildlife?
It's two things. Some farms are starting to be environmental friendly with good practices. But so far, they are rare. It's a lot of pollution coming from the farms. The quality of the fish is not comparable to wild fish. In America, the government is very proactive and a great inspiration to the world by creating quotas of what you can catch, seasons, by respecting some areas and so on. And we're starting to see more and more sustainability, especially in this country, and it's an inspiration to the world. I believe it's a middle way. We can have some good farm fish that taste good and that have good practices, and we can also have some fish coming from the ocean. It's very difficult to monitor what's going on in the water because it's not as easy as looking at a field. But today, we're starting to see some very good results.
You mentioned earlier inviting chefs for media dinners, and I'm wondering if you can talk about why you do those, and second part, how do I get an invitation?
Well, when I go somewhere and I'm really impressed, and I see a lot of talent and a lot of enthusiasm in the kitchen, I always propose to give our private event, the private room, to create a small press lunch to show off the talent of the chef and the philosophy of the restaurant. And we do that 3-4 times a year. Next, you're on the list. Starting today, you're on the list. Next time, you'll be there. But I do that because I like to share my discoveries. When I'm very enthusiastic about promoting chefs who have talent, I have zero jealousy in me, and I want them to be known, and I want them to make people happy and to be able to express themselves.
Hi, Chef.
Hello.
Thank you so much for sharing that, so much of your personal life, and it was really super interesting to hear your point of view. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the book for a minute, if I may, and would love to hear you kind of speak about your process, and did anything surprise you about the book writing process in terms of creating a memoir, which was something different for you? Was there anything that you used in the kitchen that you were able to apply to book writing? Or, you know, how are they parallel? How are they different?
So as you notice today, my English is okay. My writing is really bad. And therefore, I worked with an amazing writer, Veronica Chambers, in collaboration. And in my memoir, I understood right away that is a chronology. I mean, I was 3 years, 4 years old, 5 years old, and growing up. And that was easy for me to put on the paper. I realized also that I have an amazing long-term memory, a very poor short-term memory. I don't remember anything. But long-term, I'm excellent. And I worked with Veronica on that memoir by giving her informations about what happened in my life. And then we decided together what was important and potentially inspirational for the reader. And after that, I was going into the details, like tiny, tiny details, like the smell of the basil in the market of Nice that I could smell 100 yards before arriving at the market with precision. I could go. I went into those details. But Veronica and I work as a team. We work hundreds, maybe thousands of hours. It took us almost 3 years to do this tiny book. And ultimately, what I wanted at the end is to, like, that was the guideline. I want everything in that book is to be inspirational. For obviously people in our industry, that's the most obvious. Young people who have graduation papers in their hands and think they're going to be an amazing contribution to the world. Well, they are beginners. They're going to have to learn more and pay their dues and so on. And also, even for couples, I mean, divorce sometimes is a good thing for children and parents. But sometimes it's very bad. And in my case, it was very bad. So it talks to everyone, basically. That was what I wanted 32 Yolks to be.
Hi. I think of you as sort of the champion of quiet, kind kitchens. And I'm wondering what you would say to chefs that are currently trying to sort of transition their kitchens from the old model to the new, because I think sometimes it can be surprising for the people on the line when you stop screaming and all of a sudden you're kind and quiet. And I think a lot of chefs are afraid that people will take advantage of them if they transition like that rather than starting fresh. And I'm wondering if you have advice on that transition.
The transition is not easy, and I tell you why, because I trained my sous chefs to be screaming for years, and then I trained them to not scream. And you cannot scream at someone for not screaming. You know what I'm saying? So you cannot. So it's a very slow process if you do a transition, but ultimately it works. On the beginning, the sous chefs sometimes are not necessarily convinced that it's the right thing to do, because obviously if you scream, you have an immediate response. If you're kind and you say, listen, you burned the string beans. We don't say it like that. But we have, in our kitchen, we have a firm tone, a firm voice. When we say something, there's no room for discussion, but at the same time, it's no screaming. So I think the transition, if it is a transition in a kitchen, it's a slow process, but ultimately, whoever is smart will see the benefits of it, and the transition will happen. When we hire young chefs, it's a lot of qualities that we are looking for. But the main quality that we are looking for is the most obvious are, of course, he has to be passionate, hardworking, clean, curious, and many other qualities. But what I'm really looking for, it's for someone who can be a team player. Because you are in a team. You are with waiters working with you, with obviously cooks around you. And if you are individualistic, selfish, and cannot work with the others, you cannot really be a good cook. because in a restaurant, at one point, it's a crunch. It's the every day, lunch and dinner, we have a challenging moment, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour, an hour. And what I want is for the cooks to go help themselves in between themselves. I want them to go and support part of the team, and then the other part of the team come back, and it has to be this kind of dynamic in a kitchen. Someone who cannot do that doesn't have a room in a kitchen, and therefore, for me, is the key element for hiring someone.
Hi, Chef. Super excited to be even in the same room as you. Thanks so much speaking with us. So I work for a quick service restaurant. With the popularity of casual and quick service restaurants, where do you see the future of fine dining?
Where do I see the future of fine dining?
Yep.
Fine dining has a bright future. 10 years ago, the media started to say that fine dining was dying. And I was scratching my head because you couldn't get a table at Jean Georges or at Percy or at Le Bernardin. And I was like, what are they talking about? I never find out. But fine dining, because they're still there. And if you call now and try to get a table at 8 o'clock in any of them, even 9 o'clock, you will not get a table. You have to call a friend who has a connection and so on. But fine dining used to be different. In the 80s and previously to the 80s, it was a very formal experience. And the clientele liked that. And then it was a transformation. The younger clientele didn't want that formality. They wanted to be able to have a good time and laugh and be loud and have interaction with the waiter and ask questions and have this experience. And that was the transition for fine dining. Today, actually, with the millennials, we see that fine dining is really in high demand. Millennials go to restaurants and they want the experience of a lifetime. And only fine dining, fine dining can deliver that experience. And therefore, it has changed and is still changing and it will always evolve. But fine dining is essential and it's very vibrant and I think we're going to go far.
Okay, one more. Hi, Chef. So we're obviously talking about your book and talking about your past. You've accomplished so much, and at this point in your life, maybe as someone from the outside looking in, you're done. You've pretty much accomplished it all. But
thank
in
you.
but in your mind, in your mind, what still wakes you up in the morning and drives you? And in your mind, what do you still have left to accomplish?
I think when you have the passion and the fire inside for what you do, it never stops. I mean, in my experience, when I was 30, I was like, when I'm going to be 40, I'm going to be tired. I'm going to want to do something else. And then I was like, 50, forget it, I'll be retired. Well, I'm 51. and I'm looking at Le Bernardin, and it's where I am every day with the team. And every morning I walk to work from my house, and I have 45 minutes, 50 minutes to think about my day with the team and the mentoring process, how I'm going to work with them, how I'm going to learn from them. And it's extremely rewarding. If you are in the industry, as you all know now, you don't come in our industry to become rich and famous, because it's one for 1 million who becomes rich and famous. You come to our industry because you have the passion for cooking or hospitality. You are creative. You want to make people happy. And that is so rewarding that no age will stop this passion in you if you have it.
Well, on that note, Eric, it's truly been wonderful talking to you. I think that your honesty and your passion is it's more than inspirational, because people feel it. I mean, and you've
whether you know it or not, you have changed this world. Thank you so much for being here today with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.